Gus is one of the original seven Mercury astronauts. You have followed the manned space program from its very beginnings, and now here's your third flight after your second Mercury flight, July 21st, 1961, Gemini 3 in March of 1965. Now we're to 1967, which is when we'll be running the tapes, and Apollo 1. What impresses you most about the progress of manned flight throughout these years?
Well, I guess it's become a lot more complicated than it was, but the vehicles are very complex, and the jobs that we planned for them to do are also a very complex and very difficult job. As you know, the Apollo spacecraft is being designed to go to the moon and back, and this is a very difficult job, and so the problems have become complex, and the procedures have become complex.
When you go back to your Mercury mission, what at this point stands out as the highlight of the experience to you? The unknowns at that time?
Oh, yes, I think so. I know I still play the tapes of my Mercury flight, and I get a little choked up, but I can play the tapes of my Gemini flight, and it doesn't seem to have any real feeling like the first Mercury flight did. Those are real unknowns in those days, and even though it was 15 minutes, it was still a great thrill and a great flight.
And today you're captain of the ship for Apollo 1. Now, speaking of the captain of the ship, I'm reminded of Dr. Charles Berry's description of the captain of the ship syndrome there. Now, I guess we can assume that you're going to be the man who's all business and making all those decisions, that you're going to be the most serious man on this flight, aren't
we? Well, I don't know about that.
I facetiously throw that.
We have a well-trained crew. We work well together, and I guess the basic decision-making is my responsibility, but still would have to lean heavily on both Roger and Ed for any decisions that are made, because they're both experts in certain fields, and when you make a decision, you want all the best information you can get.
And the mission is so complex, you need all of that backup, right?
That's right. It's almost too complex for one man to know everything and be able to do everything. It takes a team.
Going back again, what would you outline your personal experiences in training and activity here in the astronaut program since your Mercury flight? Well, first of all, you did train for Gemini 3. Would you just review the things you've been doing in the last two or three years?
Well, since Gemini 3, I've been working primarily on this flight. I had a short period in there when I was back up for Gemini 6 with Wally, which was still a Gemini flight. But since coming to the Apollo program, I've been doing essentially the same things I did on Mercury and Gemini. I started living with the spacecraft, going into great detail on how it was checked out, what procedures were used, and exactly how it was done, going into developing the flight plan, developing the flight procedures, developing malfunction procedures, and essentially the same sort of thing that I've done two times before.
Mm-hmm. How has your personal life changed, the life of you and of your family, since the Mercury days?
Well, I seem to get busier all the time, and I find that I'm home less and less. And since being on the Apollo flight, I've been gone probably 5 days out of every week. I get home on a weekend, spend one day in the office, and one day at home, and then leave that afternoon is about the way it's been going.
Has public demand on your time changed much in these years?
Well, back before the Mercury flight, there wasn't any public demand on my life.
Now you're famous.
Well, I guess. When we're assigned to a flight crew, we do very little as far as the public is concerned. We're very busy trying to get a flight off, and so those demands are met by someone else who is not quite so busy.
Thank you, Gus Grissom. That's the end of one little vignette. Now, can you do some mission description? Can you just give me a 3-4 minute?
Let me go get a Coke or something. Will
yeah,
you?
Okay.
I'm thirsty.
Hold it. Okay. Gus, would you review for us the overall purposes of Apollo 1, what very often we call the mission description?
Well, the basic mission of Apollo 1 is a test flight on the whole spacecraft itself. And
did I say 1 or 201? Did I say 1?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought I had goofed, so start over.
Did I say 201?
No, you said. All right, I'll start the question again. Well, Gus, would you review for us the overall purposes of Apollo 1 and describe the mission?
Well, the Apollo 1 mission basically is to be a test flight of all the systems on board. We want to exercise them all in all of their normal modes and as many of their backup modes as possible so that the next flights could go on with the learning and with the testing that has to be done in order to get the spacecraft to the moon and back. I guess the big things on a flight really are the SPS burns that are to be made, and we have 8 of those scheduled in.
Over SPS, that's the Service Propulsion System?
That's right.
We're learning some new alphabet numbers.
Well,
here,
we always have to scatter in a bunch of letters, you know.
You wouldn't be an engineer if you didn't.
That's true. But this big Service Propulsion Engine is the means by which we'll get primarily back from the moon. So it has to work. We have 8 burns scheduled on this flight, each about spaced about 40 hours apart, and we'll burn it in all of its modes. So this is probably the highlight of the flight. If we can get all of those off satisfactorily, it would be a really great flight.
When you say we will burn it in all of its modes, we will fire the big rocket engine in a number of different manners or directions,
in a number of different ways of controlling it, actually. The guidance and navigation system can control it. We have a stabilization control system on board, which is separate from the guidance and navigation. That can control it. And then we can control it manually also.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 3 basic modes to fire it, and we'll burn it in all those modes.
Now, another important aspect of the flight is this very complex and important new guidance and navigation system, isn't it?
Yes, the guidance and navigation system is the heart of the spacecraft. And without it, it would be impossible to make it to the moon and back. You just couldn't do it manually. And so we have this checkout to do also to see what bugs are in these programs and see if there are any surprises there that we hadn't counted on.
For people elsewhere in the world who haven't seen pictures of the Apollo spacecraft and the service module, how would you describe what it looks like?
Oh, that's a little difficult for me, I guess. But the total service module and spacecraft must be about 50 feet in length.
Much larger than here before.
Much, much larger than before. And I guess on the order of 12 feet in diameter, something of this sort.
The spacecraft itself is still bell-shaped, cone-shaped.
Well, the spacecraft is cone-shaped, and the service module is essentially a cylinder.
A cylinder.
With a large rocket engine on the rear of it.
And this cone-shaped spacecraft is conforming with basic United States designs for reentry vehicles.
Yes, that's right. It's very similar to the Mercury and Gemini vehicle. It's a sharper cone. Well, I'll say not a sharper cone. I guess it's really the included angle is much larger than we've used in the past.
It's a lot roomier inside, too, isn't it?
Oh, much roomier. If I have to take a long-duration flight, which we hope this one is, why, I'm glad that it's in this vehicle. Because we can move around. We have sleep stations under the couches. We have hot and cold water. We have a lot of things that we've never had before.
Well, Gus, the room inside the spacecraft is one of the most imposing differences to previous craft in which you've flown, isn't it?
Yes. In the past, in Gemini, we've had EVA, extravehicular activity. Well, now we have IVA, which is intervehicular activity. We'll be able to float around and we expect that this will cause us some minor problems, but nothing major, we hope.
Well, now, you were also the checkout pilot for Gemini, for the Gemini spacecraft, and you've been given this honor again for the new Apollo craft. Does this mean that your mission is more important for the success of ensuing missions, or do you have to be more astute in watching the new systems and in evaluating them than future pilots will have to be?
Well, no, there's a lot more involved than that. I think one of the things is that I've done in the past and been doing this time is just making certain that the systems are being checked in the manner in which we use them, you know, and that the systems are ready to fly when we go fly. This is actually as important. The work that goes on the ground before the flight is actually as important as that, as the flight itself.
I remember one of your prominent engineers here at the Manned Spacecraft Center has told me that at one time he questioned why the National Aeronautics and Space Administration felt that it should have test pilots in the early part of its program. And as he worked with you men more and more and more, he gradually began to see how those of you with test pilot backgrounds were so well trained in being astute observers. You were trained because of your aeronautical test backgrounds in evaluating and seeing and hearing and just noticing things that maybe less experienced people or pilots would never see. Well, this is one of the things which has contributed to your participation,
well,
isn't it?
Yes, this is part of it, but you see, it's a little more than that, than being a trained observer. Back early, especially, we tried to get people who had been in test business and who had been in unusual positions and had survived them, and we felt that an individual who had himself in a hostile environment and who had lived through it was probably maybe something a little different about him than people who hadn't been in this sort of environment, and would make better observers and a little cooler heads, as we call it, and can think a little clearly and adapt a little more readily than just the ordinary man off the street.
Mm-hmm. As captain of the ship for Apollo 1, you are commanding two other astronauts, Edward White and Roger Chaffee. I wonder if you'd give us your observations on your two crewmen.
Well, they're both outstanding men. And Roger, even though he hasn't flown on a flight, is probably one of the smartest boys I've run into in a long time. He's a brilliant engineer, and he knows the systems on board the spacecraft probably better than any other one man any place, including our own spacecraft center and North American. Ed White is the type of guy that gets a job done, my guy, regardless of what's going on. Just like in his EVA, if he sets out to do a job, he's going to get it done, and he doesn't let anything stand in his way. So he's a very fine man to have on our crew, I think.
And you have been working together for a year preparing for this flight.
Yes, we've been working very closely together for some time, and we all get along very well.
Roger's one of the youngest men in the astronaut office. Do you think that possibly as one of the junior members, he feels the necessity for just a bit more hard work in order to keep up with the rest
of I think Roger's just naturally very hardworking, and he'd work that hard if he was the oldest man in the group.
Off the record, Roger appears to me, you know how the little brother, the kid, the youngest kid in the clan, he's always in there hustling more and more than the rest of them.
He's a little cocky, but he's a hard worker.
Oh,
he would be.
Oh, God, yeah. I impress you the hell out of him. Stop the tape a minute, Doyle.
Yes, ma'am.
And that would come in our worldwide special for that. Gus, how do you prepare the Apollo 1 for entry to the Earth? I think we're now calling it entry rather than re-entry with the new systems, aren't we? This is another change.
That seems to be the new word now. Well, starting about 2 to 3 orbits before we intend to re-enter, we'll bring up all of our systems, all the power systems, and align the stable element or the platform on board, which is our basic...
The platform is your guidance system.
Basic guidance system, basic attitude reference system. We'll get that all aligned using stars to align it. And then we'll go into our retrograde attitude, and at the proper time, we'll fire our SPS engine.
That's the big engine in the back.
That's the big engine on the back, and we'll fire it a certain delta V, take out a certain amount of our velocity. As soon as that's accomplished, we'll jettison the service module and that big engine, and then we'll just have the command module, the little cone-shaped vehicle, which will re-enter. The re-entry from the time we fire the engine until we're down in the water, until we have the main chutes out anyway, is on the order of about 30 minutes. Again, just like in Gemini, this vehicle is controllable as it re-enters. It is a lifting body, and we can extend our flight path downrange, or we can shorten it, or we can go cross-range a good number of miles in order to hit our landing point. Even though this is a new guidance system, and even though it should be better than the one that's on Gemini, I think we'd probably be very fortunate if we hit as close to our planned landing sites as they have been doing on the later Gemini flights, because we recognize that there are some unknowns in the spacecraft. We don't know exactly what our L over D is on the vehicle, which means
lift over drag.
We don't know exactly what that is yet. And we don't know exactly how accurately the computer can predict your position and measure our position and this sort of thing. So these are one of the important things that we expect to find out.
These are the aerodynamic factors which must be proved in flight.
That's correct.
Which you can't do on the drawing board.
That is correct.
Well, now, is the basic system designed to come in at about the same speed or about the same ground track as the Gemini? For instance, where will, assuming a nominal mission, where will you fire the retrograde burn with the SBS, and where do you expect to splash?
Well, the retrograde burn will be fired just about over the west coast of the United States, and we'll land just a little bit south of Bermuda, which is very similar to the Mercury reentries we made. The Gemini reentries were actually a little longer. We started our retro fire back almost at Hawaii. So this is comes in a little bit steeper, but there's actually very little difference between the two.
A little steeper descent, but the speed from orbit would be about the same.
That's correct.
I believe you're a little farther out in the Atlantic, though, if you're...
That's right. We do go a little farther out in the Atlantic by going out to Bermuda. So there isn't too much difference. Actually, between the time we fire and the time we hit the sensible atmosphere, which we consider 300,000 feet, is about 10 minutes. And then it's about another 15 to 20 minutes from there down to where the parachute is out.
Now, is your splash into the ocean and recovery to be about the same as in the Gemini and Mercury programs?
Yes, at 24,000 feet, we'll put out drogue chutes, which stabilize the spacecraft in a blunt end or heat shield forward position. And then at 10,000 feet, while we put out our three main parachutes, which lure us on into the water then.
When will we have land landings in our space program? Other than the landing on the moon itself.
Well, I don't think that we have any specific plans right now for land landings. We are still doing some research in this area, and there's some work that's going on. We feel that the important thing is to accomplish the mission that we're after. And the way we get the spacecraft into its orbit and the way we get it down is secondary to getting a mission accomplished. We have to have a job to do first, and the important thing is to do the job. And then, of course, we have to recover the vehicle, but it doesn't really make that much difference right now whether we do it on land or on water. I personally would prefer a land landing, but we don't feel that we can pay the penalty that it would take to put a land landing system on board at this time.
Mm-hmm. Water's supposed to be softer. There's more of it safely out there.
Well, there's a lot of it out there, and it's uniform, where if you're landing on land, why you have to be aware of ditches and poles and buildings and rocks and trees and this sort of thing. So it means you have to have some form of a terminal guidance system, which we don't have at this time.
Well, good luck on that successful completion of the mission.
Thank you.
And one more little piece just about TV, and I don't want to get it all into the sort of rigmarole they got into yesterday. Although this would be an opportunity to get a light touch in if you can on here. Follow my lead here and we'll see where it goes. I'll throw it out if it bogs down. We're going to have a television camera on. No, I'll say we have, because by the time this plays, you'll be using it, or we will have seen pictures. We have a television camera on board Apollo 1. Transmitting live pictures back of you gentlemen there in orbit. What was the basic research purpose for placing this on Apollo 1?
Well, I think the basic reason for having it on board is we intend to carry one on the lunar missions to transmit pictures back in real time. And this is one of the cameras that's being developed along that line. I think we'll probably find some good uses for it. We expect to use it when we do the transposition and docking maneuver or station-keeping maneuver. We think there are probably some interesting things, at least of human interest, that we can show of the crew on board as we eat and float around the spacecraft and this sort of thing. And possibly, we do have a zoom lens on it, possibly we can even get some good pictures of the Earth or the States as we pass overhead. About the only place that we can transmit pictures back is over the United States. That's about. We only have a few stations that can receive the picture.
I believe that the only station here on Earth prepared for processing and getting pictures back to us, the public, would be at Cape Kennedy. So we will only see live pictures of you, as I understand it, when you happen to pass over Cape Kennedy.
I think, well, there are more stations than that that can record the picture, but they're the only ones that can record it and transmit it immediately.
Yes, there are very complicated technical equipment problems in making this live television available to the public and getting it back to people overseas. But I do believe that a lot of you in Europe particularly may be able to see some of these live pictures back through the communication satellite system. I want to just drop that plug in. One of the research purposes for the TV camera was to check out the S-band transmission system, wasn't it?
Well, that's one of the objectives of our flight, is to check out the S-band transmission system, and the TV picture is transmitted through that system, yes.
Thank you very much, Gus Grissom, and we'll be looking for you on that television from space.
Thank you, Rhett.
And that'll do it. I think that's given me all. I've got these little vignettes that we drop in all over.
Okay.
And good luck to you, sir.
We need it.
God, I hope you can get it. Like you say,